Hello and welcome to Secondhand Film Critics, your favorite source for mildly pretentious, semi-uneducated, and highly unqualified opinions on slumber party movies. I am Noah, and I am joined as always by my spooky co-host,
Wiki Stick the Warlock.
Still keeping the name. Still keeping the name.
That's my spooky season name.
Incredible. It's like contractually obligated if you're online.
Pretty much. Yeah, twitter.com.
It is a website you may have heard of. When this comes out, I think it be pretty much in the throes of spooky season. So like right in the thick of it, which is always a great time, mid-October, both for Halloween and also because there's a lot of great movies coming out. So October is just like the best time for movie fans, I feel like, because you have the horror movies that you can watch at home, and then you go out and watch some movies that you hope get nominated for Oscars but never do. So today we are not talking about a new movie or even like a popular Oscar nominated movie, but we are talking about one of my favorite horror trilogies, which is the Slumber Party Massacre trilogy. Very exciting, and we are joined by a guest because I just thought that we needed like another voice on this episode because I'm definitely not the biggest, like, the person that should be just talking about this. So we brought on Bella Blondo, who I actually found from her article that she wrote on Slumber Party Massacre 2. And I read that and I was like, wow, I think we need to do an episode with her.
Yep. And then you sent it to me and you said, you need to read this and we should definitely have Bella on. And here we are.
I'm flattered that anyone read that. Wow, thank you. Thank y'all both. That's incredibly sweet.
Yeah, it was so good. But anyway, do you want to just explain what you do, what two of your podcasts are about?
Yeah, totally. So yeah, my kind of day job is I do marketing and blogging at Nataku Games, and I do social media work for Lost in Cult. But my other shows, one of them is Rocketo Punchy. I've been doing that for about 5 years with two of my best friends. And we used to be an anime podcast. We pivoted to be more pop culture, film, kind of anything in that kind of nerdy zeitgeist, that kind of pigeonhole. But we also talk about cult film and stuff a lot there. Because I'm a huge egomaniac, I decided who wouldn't want to listen to me talk about movies for 30 minutes. So I started this little side project called I Hate Movies Except When I Don't. And I've been doing that every week for like the last few months now. And it's been really fun. So yeah, that's kind of my whole deal.
Yeah, I really actually do enjoy the I Hate Movies podcast. I think it's like interesting because I feel like if you're listening to this episode, most people know what Letterboxd is, so I'm not going to explain what Letterboxd is. But it's kind of like looking through someone's Letterboxd, but like an extended version, and like hearing some more in-depth thoughts. So very fun. We'll link all of that below, and then we can replug it at the end so you guys can remember after this episode.
Cool.
So anyway, yeah, we are talking about the Slumber Party Massacre trilogy, which is three films that came out in an 8-year period over 1982, 1987, and 1990. B movie, you know, not very like big at all, you know, but they have definitely like amassed a cult following over the last, I don't know how many years, but definitely I think in the last decade. I think that one reason is because they are very fun, like, and there's a lot of fun filmmaking elements about them. But one reason I wanted to do this episode was there is a lot of like subtext to dig into in all three of them, like different subtextual elements.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much to dig into, especially I think when you learn about Rita Mae Brown, who wrote the first one, which we'll get into, and you learn about all of the people that were involved and like what the intentionality behind it was, and you realize it's so different from a normal Roger Corman production, right?
Right. And I think it's even interesting with the Roger Corman element, who, for those of you who don't know, it was like a very big Hollywood producer, produced a lot of some of the biggest movies of all time. And one of the interesting factors is like seeing what his role in these movies were. And you can definitely like see where his fingerprints are and like where it differs. But then that also like gives it another element of like that male gaze stuff, which we'll definitely talk about. It's just really interesting.
Definitely.
Everything around the movies, even more than the movies themselves sometimes.
Absolutely.
Kayla, any thoughts before we jump into the first movie here?
Sure. I watched all of these in the past 24 hours.
Rewatched.
But this was my first watch, so, yeah, this is just not, I mean, anyone who knows me knows that this is just normally not my genre. I would not normally
Wow, really?
Me watching horror? Who would have thought?
Who would have guessed?
Yeah, I don't watch a lot of stuff like this. Like, during October, I'll get into, you know, some horror kind of campy vibes. But I would not go out of my way usually to watch, you know, a series like this. Or even if I'm picking horror stuff, I'm usually not doing any kind of slasher type films. It's more, I don't know. Not that. So,
just not that. Yeah, right.
It is what it is. So I'm excited to kind of, because I know both of you guys really love this series. So I'm kind of more excited to sort of sit back and experience the conversation with you guys so that, you know, I mean, I enjoyed them. But yeah, I'm excited for this.
Yeah. Well, we'll be sure to gab away.
Great.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So we'll jump right in then to the first film, Slumber Party Massacre, which came out in 1982. Definitely like the most popular entry in the series. Lots of still in print, which again, like, why are why did the second and third one go out of print? Like, I need to buy them.
And MGM is like sitting on the thing. They, like, there was a big thing on Twitter where someone was like, hey, Kino Lorber, who owns this library now, do you want to re-release this? And whoever runs the Kino Lorber Twitter account just like completely dragged the third one and was like, no, we're not going to release that trash. We release good movies, like Jean Roland movies.
Oh, man.
Gross.
Well, not here for that.
Yeah.
But this movie, it was originally titled Sleepless Nights, which makes sense, you know, it tracks. And it was written as a slasher parody, if I'm not mistaken, by Rita Mae Brown, who is an author and feminist activist. And then, like, against her wishes, the producers then took the script and shot it as a serious slasher. So you can kind of see that, because it's a lot funnier than I think you would expect a slasher to be, but it also is played seriously sometimes.
Totally.
So that's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. There's... What I was watching one of the making of featurettes on the Blu-ray the other day, and I saw that Amy Holden Jones talked about how she took the script and like very liberally rewrote it. She described the original script as like very rough, and I really want to know what that original screenplay looked like versus what we finally got on the screen, because it sounds like they were two very like similarly aligned but different things, right?
Yeah, yeah, and she is really interesting too, because she primarily is an editor, but she wanted like a way into directing, and she chose the script out of like a big stack, and then like to prove that she could make the movie, her and her husband, like, they hired college students, and they filmed a couple scenes with like $100 at their house, $1,000, sorry, and then they showed them to Roger Corman, and he was like, okay, I guess you can make this, which is really, and she had to like turn down editing E.T. to make this movie.
That's
so
crazy.
She could have edited E.T., but she picked the correct route and made this movie.
Yeah, picked the good movie out of the two of them. No, I love E.T. dearly, but also. But yeah, I feel like that's like very indicative of like Roger Corman's production method, right? Like, I feel like for as tawdry as his output as a producer often gets, like, he gets pigeonholed into this sort of tawdry, scummy role in some people's eyes. But, like, this is the dude that, like, gave Scorsese his first break, right? Like, this is the dude who will, if you have proof that you can make something on the cheap, he doesn't necessarily always care what you're making as long as it fits, like, certain checkboxes and certain criteria, right?
Yeah, exactly. His career is just really fascinating because there's just so much, like, so many varied movies that he made, stuff like this, where it's like, sure, you can make this on a low budget, which, yeah, it was only $220,000. So pretty low for the $3.6 million it got, you know? So
Yeah that's really that's impressive.
Well. Yeah.
So before we jump into the movie itself, which is all going to be spoilers, by the way, because I don't think anyone's really listening to this like that hasn't seen the movies. It's like, definitely watch them. I think most of them, like, you can probably find online, like on YouTube. So
I feel like you can also figure out exactly what happens by the title of the movie and knowing that it's a slasher. It's like Slumber Party Massacre. Okay. A lot of girls at a slumber party are going to get slashed, like
massacred, you could say.
Yeah.
And knowing slasher movies, it's like, you know, there's going to be one at the end who finally kills the bad guy and then cries. Like, it's just the it follows the perfect slasher formula, I feel
and
like.
And then cries.
Truly, truly.
That's good.
Okay, so I'll read this first synopsis here. It's hard to find synopsis for these, so I took some framing from one I found on IMDb by Ed Sutton, and then I added a lot of additions because it was definitely a little bit sexist, so I like just took the framing.
Yikes.
And then I'll like change a lot of the stuff. We have 18-year-old Tris Juveau left at home by her parents, and she decides to invite her friends over for a good old-fashioned slumber party. However, there is some tension between some of the invited guests and the new girl, Valerie. So she decides to stay at home with her sister while the other girls have a party across the street. Meanwhile, mass murderer Russ Thorne has escaped from prison, armed with a deadly power drill. Eventually, Russ makes his way to the party and begins terrorizing the girls. Will they escape the clutches of this driller killer, or will they fall into their final slumber?
Wow, that was good. That Chilling. Last line was, yeah, that was good. Good job.
I learned from the best, Caleb.
Uh-huh. I like how it says, like, good old-fashioned slumber party. And, like, I know that I grew up in a more conservative environment, so my slumber parties were, like, definitely not, like, this wild by any means. Like, not even close. But I work with high schoolers now, and, like, most of their slumber parties don't reach this caliber either. Like, I feel like it's very rare to have a very, like, wild slumber party like this.
Yeah, I feel like it's not really common that you see, like, high schoolers getting, like, drilled apart by people. I agree.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe it was different in the 80s. I don't know. Yeah. The 80s might have been.
That's what they call it, the drilling years.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do agree, though. It is funny. Like, each of these three, are like very big parties that are like, I mean, not big parties, but for me, like, I wouldn't expect to see this. But like, also, I think it makes a little sense because they're all seniors and like the parents are away. And it's just like the cliche, you know, the parents are away, the neighbor's next door, but you know, maybe we can get away with it. Yeah, it's an interesting, like, very by the numbers setup.
Mm-hmm.
For something that seems by the numbers, but then like if you dive deeper, it's actually a little bit more. So I first saw this movie last year. I watched it because, you know, people said it was good. I don't really have a big reason. And yeah, I loved it from like the moment I saw it because I love slashers. That's definitely my favorite horror genre. Or just anything where it feels like this could really happen, you know?
Yeah.
So with, like, having that element of, like, a killer on the loose, like, Texas Chainsaw Massacre is probably the scariest movie for me because, like, that just feels like, wow, this could happen. Like, this probably happened at some point. And
grimy presentation of that movie adds a lot to that too, right? It's like you feel like you're right there, like right in the muck of getting chased by Leatherface in that first one. It's really just unsettling.
Yeah, the final scene is like the most anxiety I've had during a movie. But this movie's similar because it's obviously lower budget, and so it feels a little bit like that more like grimy feeling where the picture isn't super clear. And especially as it gets like to the darker scenes, it's not like crystal clear. You can't see everything. And so I get a little bit of sense of that too here. And as we'll get into, another reason I liked it was it just felt like there was more going on under the surface than just like, oh, guy escapes and kills people and then dies. The end.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot more going on than that. Like, I think that that's, like, the merit of this franchise is, like you mentioned, just, like, this very lurid explanatory title that kind of belies or, like, kind of betrays the depth that the especially the first one has. I think that the thing with the first one that is so terrifying, like that first Texas Chainsaw Massacre, is that Russ Thorne himself is just like, he's just a guy with a van. And like, how many serial killers, like how many like atrocities are committed to women by a guy in a van with some power tools? And I think like out of the three of them, it's like one of the most chillingly realistic in terms of just like the type of guy that does this to people, right?
Well, and they show you him the whole time. Like, it's not like he's wearing a mask like Michael Myers or anything like that. Like, he's just there doing it as himself, which you're like, yikes, I don't like that at all by any means.
Yeah. That look in his eye too, and like him just like killing someone and just going like, I love you. That's just terrifying. Just like chilling stuff.
Yeah, and also just the fact that it is a drill, like a power tool. So this guy could have just gone down to his local Home Depot and just like bought this. Like, this is, it just makes it feel like a lot more real, like you said. I think the lack of a mask does do that. I didn't really consider that, because it's not like they're trying to hide anything, or they're not trying to make him seem like an otherworldly person. Like, he's just like a guy.
He is very much, I think, like, because every male character in this movie, I think, is presented as a threat at some point. You have, yeah, like these POV shots of every male character at some point, or like the neighbor next door with the knife kind of chopping up slugs and him being framed as a threat. Like, every man is scary, much in the way that every man is scary IRL. And so what makes Russ Thorne so terrifying is that, like, you know, you could just really walk past him in the street, especially back then, if that, with that denim fit. That's just how men dressed, I think.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I totally agree. I think a lot of the POV stuff is some of the most interesting things in this movie, because you have, okay, multiple layers of the scene where it's the two guys looking in on the girls changing, which one was like a scene that Roger Corman wanted in the movie, because like he said, you have to have nudity. So you have that element where like it's him behind the scenes telling her, you have to shoot this. And then second of all, it is shot though, like it could be the killer, like looking like that kind of like creeping camera, very shaky, just like in the corner of the window. And it, that's the POV obviously of the boys, but it's shot the same way as they would shoot the POV of Russ, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's something that is permeable throughout the trilogy, which we'll get into, is that like every male character is either unmanned at some point in terms of like the classical Shakespearean sense of like the unmanning of a male character, or the just like he is presented, every boyfriend, every like just side dude makes an offhanded comment, and then you see them do something that is threatening. Even if they're just like walking up and like touching a woman on the shoulder or wrapping their arms around them, it's that same sort of fear that you feel when like you are just in public and you're like, is this guy gonna touch me? Is this dude gonna touch me? Or is this dude I trust gonna like take this boundary a step too far and just like put his hand on me a little too long, right? It's that kind of fear in which you're conditioned to see men, like I mentioned, like as a threat, because that's kind of what you have to do to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's so many things in this movie that draw you in. I mean, there's so many like great filmmaking things in this. Like, one of my favorite things is you have the body in the refrigerator, and then you have the girl that she's like going like, I'm gonna get a soda or something, I don't know, or a beer actually, and then she like opens it, but you see the body fall out and you're like, oh my god, what is happening? And she's like, okay, and she shuts it. Just stuff like that where you get some of that dramatic irony in there, which is very big in slashers. Like, the audience knows that there's danger, but the character's like unaware until the last second. Things like that, I think, just elevate the movie to a place where like they didn't have to do that. You know, they didn't have to put in like those more interesting scenes with just that kind of stuff, because this is a very low budget movie that they were just releasing to make a quick buck, like apparently. But they put the time, or she put the time and effort to like really make those things shine through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that when you think of like the budget this movie is made on, it's very telling that it was made by someone who is a professional editor beforehand, who was working with big directors, who did stuff at, I think, UCLA. I think she did some stuff there, because it's this very deliberate editing and very deliberate presentation of every single like set piece, every single kill as a filmic thing. It's not just like a down and dirty, like I think like the third one we'll get to is much more like this violence is visceral. I am in it. The camera's shaking. I feel tense. Some of the kills in this one feel so orchestrated and deliberate. There's that one where the boyfriend is getting murdered on the front lawn, and I think that's his girlfriend or one of the main female characters is watching basically the same thing play out to a woman on the screen in front of her. And as this guy is dying and getting stabbed in her front lawn, with each stab, she is watching a woman get stabbed on the screen and is oblivious to what's happening outside. It's just very clever, and something I think that could have only been done by somebody who has like an almost fetishistic knowledge of film.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of that stuff too, I feel like, is homage to like Halloween, you know, with having the girls in the other house watching the horror movie and then stuff happening across the street, which happens in this because you have Valerie and her sister next door where they're just chilling, having a good time, you know, like do it. Just nothing's going wrong for them. But then I think the movie, the ending is really elevated when they arrive, because it's like a new character entering the space rather than someone that's already like, I just feel like in slashers, like once they know there's a killer, it sometimes gets boring for me because it's like, okay, so now they know he's here and now they're just going to run or like chase. But having them arrive after like all that's already happened in the house is like basically the same, another movie, you know, because another set of characters has to discover this.
Absolutely.
And I love the ending too. Like, cause it was going to end just in the living room. Like they were just going to have him die in the living room, but having it, having him come alive that one more time outside, and then you have the visual imagery with like the drill getting cut in half and him falling in the pool. I don't know. It's just like, there's like, it just is the cherry on top for this one.
Yeah. That final scene, I think, is, I was watching his interview with the guy who plays Russ Thorne, Michael Villela. I might be totally butchering that, but he described that, because he method acted this whole role, right? Like, well, all of these actresses and actors were eating lunches together and taking breaks. Like, he would sit and he would just, like, put Vaseline on the drill and just, like, sit there and do that. And he didn't interact with the rest of the cast. So he was, like, super, super immersed in the role. So a lot of that, like, fear of the actors and actresses is like, yeah, this dude we barely interact with is pretending he's trying to kill us, and he's doing a really convincing job. And so he described getting so into the role that when that drill bit got cut, he was like, yeah, it felt like my dick had been cut in half. Like, I felt like it was actually cut in half. And I'm like, wow, that's kind of alarming you got so into this role, dude.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I think what's very interesting about this is the way in which he dies. There is the very yonic imagery of him being cut open and there being a slit that opens up on him, and then he like falls in the pool and he kind of like is injured. And then when he rushes them, the final way that they get to him is he jumps up and they penetrate him like right where that incision is, which is just like a very biting way for this like guy who preys on women to die. And I really like that imagery a lot.
Yeah, you can tell, like, it's not just, like, they stab him in the back because, like, the kill itself means something, which is, I think, not always the case because, you know, most people would just say, well, he's just going to die, you know?
Yeah,
We'll just blow him up, you know? Whatever looks coolest.
Yeah.
this one, we'll get into the other ones in a second, but just to kind of wrap this one up, this is probably on par with the last one for me in terms of, like, a ranking. I'd probably say this might be my least favorite just in terms of like it's the most by the numbers. So it would in one sense be the one that I probably would want to watch the most, definitely more than the third.
Right.
But it's just like once you watch the other ones, I think it even makes this one a little bit better because like the way that those contextualize this movie just make it better. So this like is at the bottom, but it's still like a very good movie, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's, I think that's kind of how I feel about this one as well, is it's still an excellent film. I think all three of them are excellent films, but within that canon, within that kind of almost anthology, even though the second one's connected, that anthology vibe, this one does feel like the one you could show somebody who doesn't like these sorts of movies ordinarily, and they would get it, and they would jive with it more, I think, than the next two. I think the next two are definitely my favorite, but they are more for genre enthusiasts, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, this one would be at the bottom of the list for me, too, even though it's still just a very excellent film.
It's like vanilla ice cream. Like, it's like, you can't go wrong. It's a classic.
Yeah.
Yeah, moving into the second one now, which came out 5 years after that. So waited a bit. This one actually doubled the budget, actually a little more than doubled at 500,000. Only brought in 1.3 million, but like, it's a sequel and, you know, it's to be expected. Mm-hmm. It was filmed under the title Don't Let Go, which, you know, does make sense, I think. Don't let go of reality, I guess. I don't know.
Or of like the past of your trauma. And then there's that song, yeah. Don't Let Go. And there's the line in the script where she's holding her at the, well, you'll get into it, where she says, don't let go. It's like, I wish they had kept that as a subtitle. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Slumber Party Massacre 2, : don't let go.
Yeah.
Yeah. There we go. Maybe in the upcoming hopeful release, you know, they can remedy that.
Yeah.
One thing that I thought was interesting was that they were going to have the same actor play Matt, who is like the main
boyfriend. Yeah.
And then have him also play the killer to show two sides of the same coin, which is an interesting thought. But yeah, as we'll get into, I actually think having him just be like, seem like a good guy is, I think, integral to like how the plot plays out.
Yeah,
definitely.
It is an interesting thing to consider. And like, already shows that they were thinking about this on a deeper level than just a horror movie sequel, because that's like a very like, what's the word I'm looking for? Intentional detail.
Absolutely. And like, I think that shows how much construction is behind this movie. I hate to just pull David Lynch as my catch-all surrealist example, but like, there are vignettes in this movie. There are these dream sequences that are shot and play out with the same sorts of camera work and strange, like almost human, but not quite human behavior of like a Lynch production of, say, like an Inland Empire or whatever. And that's what really stood out to me about this, because you're right. It's not just this goofy sequel. It is sometimes, but it has deeper aspirations there and kind of moves the needle a little bit about where this franchise could potentially go, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have another synopsis here. Again, this was some framing from that guy in IMDb with a lot of editing additions by me. So we have Courtney, who is Valerie's younger sister from the first one. Valerie was the girl across the street, so this is her younger sister, Courtney. She's now in high school, and while she didn't become institutionalized from the event like her sister, Courtney still suffers from constant nightmares about that fateful night, haunted by a greaser serial killer with a drill bit at the end of his guitar, which is exactly how it sounds. To celebrate her birthday, she and the other members of her rock group go to a condo for the weekend to play music and have fun with their boyfriends. However, Courtney's violent dreams begin to spill into real life, making her question what is actually real and what is just a visitor from her nightmare.
Who knows?
That's really it is. Like, who knows? That's the whole movie where, like, what is real right now?
There is no, it was all a dream moment. Like, you know, as you're watching the movie, as you see it all, like, fall into place and you look back at it retroactively, like, of course this is a sequence of dreams. That, we see the character have these dreams throughout the entire movie, in fact. At the same time, there is never that, like, cozy, like, oh yes, I'm waking up and I understand my trauma now because of this dream. Like, nah, that's not how this plays out at all.
Right.
Yeah, that's a great point. Like, there's no reprieve. Like, you feel like, okay, I think we're safe now, but then all of a sudden, like, oh, something else happens. Like, we're in a dream within a dream. Like, what is this, Inception? Yeah, it's a very well directed movie in that sense.
Yeah, and when it ended too, I even thought that I was like, okay, so was it a dream? And then I was like, well, was it actually her boyfriend that killed everyone? And she just was imagining this other person, like, as her boyfriend in a dream. And I was like, well, I feel like I'm overthinking this. I feel like it was just all a dream.
You're not no, overthinking
it. That's the thing. Is like, what I think is so good about this movie is that, like, people have all sorts of reads on, like, what happened and what she's dreaming about and what her dreams mean, if it all is a dream. It's the way that Courtney, I think, is, and I do think it's Courtney, like, is contextualizing her trauma gives rise to, like, people being able to come away from this movie with that read or with, like, 12 other reads. And I think that's what makes it such a fascinating and compelling movie is there is no pat explanation for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like trauma.
Right.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I really do love the dream aspect, too. Also because it allows them to do a lot of really interesting visual things and have the movie be a lot more colorful than the first one. I mean, it's definitely like leaning into that really like this is late 80s, you know, that 80s vibes, like all the carpeting and the dance sequences.
The rock band.
So they get to do the rock band. They get to do all that fun stuff as well, like and add in those more just a different stylistic element than the first one, which was very like a traditional slasher, where this one has a like it allows it to be a different thing.
Yeah definitely.
Absolutely. It plays around with genre so much that like it's a horror comedy, but you can't really put it in a box, right? That's what my mom told me about growing up with this movie. She was obsessed with this when she was in her teens, and like her late teens, she and her roommate like lived together, and they went and rented horror movies, and they started from A and went to Z of their local video shop. And
that's kind of iconic, not gonna lie. Wow.
Yeah.
And so my mom, who, you know, waited tables and eventually did like stuff in the medical field, and her roommate, who was like a stripper, had this like constant rotating experiences of bad men they were dealing with on a daily basis, and they would bond over horror movies. And so this one in particular, as I was growing up, my mom talked up watching dozens and dozens of times. And I think one of the reasons for that is that it represents so much like feminine trauma and all of the places that that can come from without making some sort of big picture statement. It can be cathartic. It can show like, yeah, Your boyfriends put you through this shit. Random men that you've never met put you through this shit. Police officers don't believe you when men put you through this shit. It shows there's this trickle-down effect of how misogyny can subjugate women, but it's also presented in like a very surreal, fun way so you can enjoy watching it. And I think about my mom in the 80s and her roommate watching this, and I'm like, yeah, this was probably super cathartic. This probably felt great. No wonder y'all watch this all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Something that actually just came to me, I don't remember the name of the movie, but you talked about a movie on your podcast where it was set in the 80s, but they had a 50s like flashback.
Night of the something. Creeps.
Right, okay. And you talked a lot about like how the 80s movies were just obsessed with the 50s and like the kind of conservatism of that era, but also like patting themselves on the back, like, look how great we are now. Just like how 80s movies just, like you said, were obsessed with the 50s. And I think this one is an interesting version of that because there is a 50s element with the greaser who is like a 50s style, 60s style rocker.
Yeah.
But obviously he's like the most terrifying thing in the movie. Instead of being like, look at this nice time where everyone was happy and Americans were like the best, I don't know, like, but now, like, this is the 50s, you know, this is what the 50s actually were like. And so taking that thing that you think they're gonna show as like the happy good thing is the villain.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's very interesting here is the Driller Killer not only represents that like rampant 50s misogyny, because the 50s was nothing if not racism, misogyny, and white picket fences, but I think what's super interesting about him is he is, if you watch the cut that has like that cut footage that's put back in that's really grainy, there is that scene where she has a poster of the killer, like the actor who plays the killer, on her wall next to a bunch of rock dudes, I think from the following decades. And what I think is interesting about him is not only does he represent like a 50s rocker or greaser, a lot of the music he's playing and the iconography that like they employ to make him so threatening, like that very pelvic guitar, is very similar to a lot of like hair metal dudes in the 80s, like those kind of like Def Leppard or what's it, who's like a really bad hair metal man who's like done bad things, Bret Michaels, like a Bret Michaels kind of guy, right? And so I think what makes him work so well is that he is this example of rock and roll male id throughout the decades, all coalesced into this killer that metastasizes into this lurking specter of violent misogyny that is rampant across rocker guys, regardless of what era they came from, right? Like he is the violent male id.
Totally, totally. And it's like another thing with the dreams and hallucinations, like taking something that she loves, which is rock music, because she's like in a band, that's obviously what she loves doing, and like twisting that and using it against her, where like this guy is a rock and roll guy, but it's like her worst nightmare. Yeah. So there's a lot of things in there, I think, where you can see the reality intermixing with the fantasy or the dreams, and that's always really interesting to me, because that's how dreams actually work, is you take what happened in your day or what's in your life, and your brain kind of tries to contextualize that with what it's trying to process, and it all kind of meshes together.
Definitely, definitely. And a very messy, unexplainable way, right?
Kayla, do you have anything to say about this one?
I don't know. I liked this one. I thought it was definitely very interesting. I liked a lot of the, like, how it, I mean, it took a long time before he started, like, killing people. And so I liked that it gave you all this build-up of these dream sequences and stuff like that, where you're like, oh, is this where it starts? And then it's like, oh, okay, no, we're still good right now. And then they had, like, oh, well, who turned on the trash compactor? And you're like, oh, so this is where it starts. I see. But then it still doesn't start, and you're like, oh, phew, okay, we're good for now. But I like how the suspense is played with through those different, like, sequences and stuff in this one. Because you kind of know what's coming, especially if you've seen the first one, because you feel like it'll probably play out pretty similarly. So definitely, I like how they, you know, put all that together to kind of lead you into different things. Or even, like, the pool sequence, where you're, like, already getting frustrated with the guys who,
oh my gosh,
you know, like, one of my pet peeves is guys who throw women into pools. It just, like, drives me up the wall. I think it's one of the worst things in the world. So when he did that, I was like, ugh, this is how the rest of the movie is gonna be. It's just these awful men, like, being awful. Even if they're not the killers, it's like they're still being awful the whole time. So I like that aspect of it too. I mean, I don't like it, but I like it. You know what I mean?
No, I know what you're saying. Yeah, yeah. And I think you can't talk about this movie without touching on the ending, which I think this is why you have to have the other guy, like, be a different actor, the boyfriend, because I don't think you're, I think you can't suspect that he is evil. You know, I don't think that can be something that you think until that final scene where she wakes up in bed and you think it is going to be like, oh, it was just a dream. And now I'm with my boyfriend. And it's actually the driller killer. Uh-huh. And it's like, that would be the last person you'd expect to do that, you know, because like everything that they've showed, he's the only male character in the series so far that hasn't been like a complete dick.
Yeah.
So it's just a really amazing, like, subversion of expectations there.
Yeah, and exactly. And I'm glad both of y'all brought this up, because I like what this movie is ultimately trying to say, is that she has found, like, you know, as safe as a man can be, like, a safe man, like, somebody who she can share her trauma to, who believes her and is like, hey, you guys need to stop being terrible to her because she's been through some really rough shit. And that stuff feels super validating and safe. but it, like when you have gone through trauma and you have had that experience. And so I think at the end, it's very telling that even in this safe space, she is not free from that trauma. She's not mm-hmm. free from that fear. She is still scared of men, which, you know, rightfully so. She's really terrified of even this guy is going to, like, violate her inner sanctum, which is her fear of being locked up like her sister. And we see that, like, as like represented as a drill that comes through the asylum floor at the very
literally
end.
Literally the most amazing shot. It's such a good final shot.
It's very music video-y, like the rest of yeah. this movie is. Sorry.
No, that's a great point.
Oh. Yeah, it's directed like a music video, and so I think like there's a lot of things that you can take away as visual metaphors, like that drill at the end. But like, I think my favorite visual metaphor in the entire movie is all of her relationships with food. I have like really, I used to be super anorexic. I had a really bad eating disorder for like a decade, and so when I watch the beginning of this movie, like especially in this cut scenes where she's like playing with her food for a minute straight and picking it up and like putting it back somewhere else and picking it around and taking a small bite and like trying to get away with it while her mother is watching her like a hawk. It's like, yeah, I used to do all of this when I was anorexic. So watching that then go to, I'm eating a sandwich that has a hand on it, or this chicken is alive. Like, when you have trauma and it compounds itself as an eating disorder, every single bit of food becomes a monstrous to you. And this movie shows her real grounded reaction to her eating disorder at the beginning, and then it shows the actual feeling of what that feels like to live with later on. Mm. And I just think that's, it's very beautiful too, because of course she has food trauma, because she was the one who opened the fridge that had the corpse in it, right? Like, wasn't she the one who originally found that?
Yeah,
so indeed. She has like a trauma tied to eating. And the pizza delivery guy too, like she saw these girls eat pizza around a corpse. Like, of course she'd have a weird relationship with food. Like, that makes total sense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love how, like, watching the first one for a second time after having seen this, in like trying to look at, like, really pay attention to her character and those things that would then influence her character in the second one, and try to explain some of that. There's just so much there, like the food thing, and just like how just comfortable she is with like herself and just with boys, and just like she's just like really like the nicest person in that movie, you know. Yeah. Her and her sister.
Yeah.
And then you see her in this movie and it's like just really sad, because yeah. you see all of like the, well, I don't know. It's just like, I think a really great way of showing how trauma can like ruin a person or it for a while, you know, yeah. like how that really just becomes who you are.
Yeah. I think that's why she's like my favorite, like final girl in a movie. Like, if we're going to go on that like trope, is that like, I feel like often the ways that trauma is shown in female characters in movies is like kind of unbelievable and kind of borders on like misogynistic depictions of a hysterical woman, right? And I think that this movie doesn't ever do that. It gives her trauma room to breathe and mm-hmm. turns it into something scary and shows it as something she's working through with the support of her friends that like watch her fail and try to pick her back up, and because they care about her, because they're her band, or it's like her boyfriend. And yeah, I just think that it's like one of the most realistic depictions of trauma, despite the fact that it is probably the most unrealistic movie out of the three.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so do we have anything else to say about the second one? Because I know there's a lot to say about this one, so want to make sure I don't like move on before we are finished.
I think just the one thing that I want to say about this movie is that it's a very good example of a movie that people should take more seriously, even if it is goofy, even if it is like silly. I feel like if something ever veers towards camp or a low budget thing or tries to be funny, people sort of start writing it off and they sort of like mentally file it under one of those movies. But you have to understand, which y'all both do, but other people have to understand that like kaleidoscopic music videos with weird camera angles and fast cuts were like the primary method of reaching like teenagers to 20 somethings when this movie came out. And this is yeah. a whole movie that is like one of those, but it's about something that is way heavier and in a way antithetical to a lot of the music that was on the airwaves, that is antithetical to a lot of the popular men of the time. So it's using, it is using a medium, it is using a presentation method that is very codified in popular culture to make something that is counterculture. And that's why this is my favorite of the trilogy. I know we're saving definitive rankings for the last, but I just have to say, like, this is, Slumber Party Massacre 2 is, like, one of my favorite movies. Like, it's in my top 10. And I think that it's a great example of a film that you should take on its own merits as opposed to pigeonholing it as a goofy horror comedy with music in it and a guitar killer. Instead of going, wow, what's a guitar killer? You should ask, yes, but why is there a guitar killer? That's kind of the thing.
Right.
So I love this movie. I love this movie so much.
I agree with all of that. It is my favorite of the three as well, and just like an amazing film. So moving on to the final film of the trilogy from 1990 is Slumber Party Massacre 3. Who would have guessed it?
No colon, no anything. So,
yeah, just three. Just three. There's like the least information. Like as you go through the movies, there's less and less information about these. But I did find a couple fun things. One is that the opening scenes on the beach were shot on a freezing cold day in January. So
yikes,
that doesn't seem like a fun time.
No.
With this movie that, this became, one of the only slasher series to not only have all female directors, but all female writers as well.
Yeah.
Which pretty cool.
The only one, literally the only one, which is like kind of messed up, but yeah.
Yeah. With all the slasher series there are out there, like,
yeah.
Dear Lord.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Absolutely.
And this came out in 1990. Like, it's been 31 years since this movie came out. So this is like, these are just hard to write synopsis for. So this is like not a very great synopsis, but I wrote this just because we needed something. It's a great day in sunny California, and Jackie and her friends are at the beach playing volleyball. Afterwards, Jackie decides to throw, again, a good old-fashioned slumber party with her girlfriends while her parents are away looking for a house. Unfortunately, the party is continuously plagued by a creepy next-door neighbor, a sketchy stalker, and their annoying boyfriends. What's worse, there is a murderer hiding outside in the shadows, just waiting to make his next move.
That's good. That was all you.
That was all me. No Ed Sutton here.
Beautiful.
No sexism.
Yeah.
In this one. It's all from the heart. I watched this for the first time a few days ago because, like, I think I just assumed that it wasn't anywhere because Letterboxd said it wasn't anywhere. But then I looked it up and it was on YouTube and I was like, oh, okay. Well, I guess I can watch it. Like going into it, I definitely had my expectations low because I think most people agree this is the worst one. I don't agree with that, but I think that seems to be like the consensus. It has, out of all the low aggregate scores, the lowest aggregate score. And it just seems like because the first two are connected, like this one kind of just is tacked on, you know. That's what I feel like it could seem from the outside. Like, is this really necessary? It's not connected. But this movie is not only a really good movie, but also I think like the best way that they could have ended this trilogy.
Yeah.
For many reasons, which we'll get into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I think that, which we'll get into, I think that the first two dwell in a very heightened reality. The first one obviously dwells in that heightened slash reality. The second one's in like music video. This is probably like the most honest out of the three of them in terms of like, it's showing these all of these thematic elements that have always been in the series, but I think it's showing them in the rawest, in most, like, grounded way yet. And I think yes, that produces this movie that's, like, chilling. Like, it's genuinely a chilling movie, even if you've seen, like, a bajillion horror films, right?
Yeah, I like in this one how pretty much all the male characters are, like, awful. And, like, pretty much any of the male characters, you're like, they could be, you know, the worst as well. Or they could be the killer. Or maybe it's multiple killers. Maybe it's not just this guy. Because you have, like, you know, the guy from the beach and the neighbor. And the neighbor is, like, creepily watching them.
I just want to say, yeah, I agree with you. Just, like, I really like how this movie just you don't know who the killer could be. Like, the trailer spoils it, which sucks, but, like,
I didn't watch the trailer.
Like, we watched it after the fact for, like, the first time yesterday, and we were like, wait a second, they just say it's this dude right away. You don't find that out until, like, an hour in, and the reveal is,
it's
like, chilling.
That is what's so tense about it, too, because at first you're like, oh, well, it could be that guy, but it also could be, you know, this kid that's stealing the pizza shirt, and, you know, who is this guy? You don't know. And then even with, like, the police officers as well, like, they're so mean and whatnot, and so it's like, they frame the kind of good police officer as like, oh, well, I'll go check it out. And it's like, yeah, but you also could have said something, or you could have said, let me talk to them, or maybe they're not, like, faking it. So I love how that is just, you know, all men suck.
Yeah.
Except Noah. But
yeah, yeah, absolutely. I hate men so much, I decided to stop being one. But I, like, I straight up just... I love how antagonistic the cops in this movie are, like, especially, like, the first one they are, but this one is just, like, there are these teenage girls calling and being like, help us, a man is trying to kill us, we are literally dying, my friends are dead, and he just, like, cusses them out and tells them to go away, and it's
especially,
very telling.
It's even more telling than when the neighbor calls and he's like, I need to report a disturbance, and he's like, I'll send someone over without even asking, like, any questions or anything like that, and was like, oh, uh-huh, it's because it was a man, right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, like, the way, too, I think that, like, they show that the cops not only, like, refused to address this problem, but a cop was the beginning of why this is all happening to begin with. A cop abusing a child is like, oh, wow, I know what this movie's about, or one of the things it's about.
Well, especially when the guy was, like, talking about the cop and was like, oh, yeah, he kind of was, like, messed up or whatever, or wasn't right in the head. And it's like, wouldn't that be, like, a red flag, like... for that person to be working in the police department? I don't know. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I feel like, I mean, on the one hand, it's like none of the police officers in these movies should be police officers. On the other hand, these are exactly the types of guys that become police officers. So,
Yeah, with the cops, it's like they planted the seed a little bit in the second one. But this one, it, like, really doubles down on just, like, how awful the cops are, because it cuts to think, like, at least 3 times, maybe 4 times at the police station, with this guy just, like, ignoring these calls where both times they're legitimate calls, like, there's a legitimate complaint happening right now. And it's just another layer to it where it's not just, like, the high school boyfriends or the murderers that are, like, terrible people. It's, like, the people that are supposed to be the authority, you know, mm-hmm. are also, like, on the same level as all the other men that we've seen in the series so far. So,
yeah,
it's, I think, really a great aspect to have in this last movie because, like you said, this is definitely the rawest feeling one. It takes away, like, pretty much all the camp, like, there's still campy stuff just because of the nature of the movie,
totally.
But it takes away a lot of, like, the campiness and, like, I guess slumber party vibes that, like, I could watch this as a slumber party. It just feels a lot more raw than that, and because of that, I think it should be grounded more in reality, where, like, okay, so in reality, I guess I would try to have to turn to, like, whatever authorities we have, you know. And even in that case, it's just, like, no use.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's specifically interesting about this is it shows how enshrouded the system of masculine violence is, right? You see these teenage boys doing the awful stuff that teenage boys do. You have cops sort of looking down on the whole scenario. You have, like, the outsider teenage boy who comes in and is like, he could be a threat. They perceive him as a threat, even though he's, like, kind of nice, kind of creepy. But as Duncan is his name, he's like, yeah, can you take off your shirt for $45?
That was such a weird scene.
Such a weird bit. And so what I think is fascinating about this is, like, yes, when you find out who the killer is, it's like, this man is taking advantage of this situation, and he is only doing this because an authority figure in his life took advantage of him, and the current authority figures who are looking in from the outside as these, like, young girls are saying, please help us, we are literally dying, they are ignoring that. And it really shows how masculine violence metastasizes in society and how the power structures in place always fail to, I think, address it adequately, right?
Yeah, totally. That's why I think this is really the best way that this to end the series, because it not only just depicts the male aggression and violence, but it tries to, I think, look at it from a wider stance. Like, why is this such an issue? Why is every man in this, in basically, like, ever, like this, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think it does a really good job of that, of with the killer, how it's a real subversion, even from the first one, where it's not a Michael Myers again, and it's not like a escaped mass murderer that is like a known sociopath that like came from a prison. It's like the blonde guy that you met at the beach that you're excited, like, to hope you'll come to the party, you know? It's almost like the character in the second one. I forget his name, but, like, the guy that's supposed to be, like, the good guy, I guess.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it shows how those are the types of, like, teenage boys and men. He has a very Patrick Bateman-y vibe about him. Like, he is this photogenic, attractive man to these teenage girls, who is like, yes, I'm strapping, I'm hanging out on the beach, I'm muscular, I'm this pretty boy, right? And it's often those types of guys that take advantage of the way that the world sees them in order to just do atrocious things. And those atrocious things have roots in what men did to them in the past, right? And I think what's also interesting about this movie is that it's like maybe one of the only ones that shows also how, when put in these situations, like, regardless of if you are the person being targeted, you are not susceptible to bystander effect. You're not susceptible to letting this happen, because my favorite character in the movie, I believe her name's Maria, as the killer is, like, stabbing her repeatedly, her three friends just sit there and they just watch it happen at any point. He's, like, groping her and touching her and doing all these just, like, probably the most violating stuff that we have seen.
That's, like, the hardest scene to watch, like, in the entire series for sure, and just, like, in general. It's so hard.
Absolutely.
I skipped it.
No, that's fair.
I don't blame you.
Yeah, watching that just, like, it made me flash back. It's, like, one of those scenes that if you've had an experience like that, it makes you flash back to it. And you are sitting there and you're like, oh, she's clearly alone. All of her friends have left her. And then you're like, oh, no, he's temporarily blinded by this Clorox. And instead of, like, trying to help their friend, they're like, yeah, she's just, like, she's the offering. She's the one that we're letting this happen to until we can be safe. And as the film, when you know, the dude gets offed and they, like, everything's done, no one feels good. No one's like, we finally did it. They're all sitting around looking traumatized and shaken and scared, like the ending of the first one. But unlike the ending of the first one, we have the added, like, window into how this guy ended up like this, which makes it all the more terrifying, because the whole scenario feels thoroughly fucked. And that's how patriarchy is. It's thoroughly fucked and seemingly inescapable. And I think this movie captures that very well. Also, yeah, Maria, best character. Everyone harps on her line delivery, and they're wrong. I just want to say for the record, she's the best one.
I think there's a lot of good friend dynamics in this one, like, of the three. Like, I like the main friend group in this one a lot. Anyway.
Absolutely.
I like how these movies kind of almost make you think, like, what would I do? All three of them, because, like, there's the scene in the second one where they're, like, up in the bedroom and the girl comes up the stairs and is, like, they start moving the stuff and then realize he's out there. And it's, like, what would you do? Like, would you be the person who would maybe sacrifice yourself to let them in? Or would you, like, you compromise your own safety in a situation and, like, watch your friend be mutilated? Or would you, you know, try to step in and whatnot?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I think it's very interesting the way, like, the characters specifically they frame that with, because, like, you know, if I were to be reductive about these characters' roles, like, Maria is supposed to very much be, like, the quote-unquote promiscuous one, the quote-unquote, mm-hmm. like, dumb one, the quote-unquote sexy one, right? And yet, she is the one who repeatedly through the movie is like, I'm gonna smash this lamp on this guy's head. I'm gonna try to blockade myself in. I'm gonna try to be like a person to escape and help you through the window. I'm going to like distract the killer. Like, she is the one who I think in a male-made horror movie is often the one who would die first in the most horribly misogynistic way possible. And in this movie takes this archetype and is like, no, we're going to subvert this very deliberately by, like, doing this overt sexualization of this actress and giving her this personality. And yet, she is the one who, throughout the whole movie, is arguably, like, one of the most helpful. Hmm. More than the protagonist, at least.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that ending, too, is just,
ooh,
like, such a dark ending because, like you said, it's really interesting how they don't want to kill him, or like they're not going to kill him, and then yeah. he comes back, and like just like the depths they have to go to actually like be safe, like the way they have to almost even violate their own morals, like just to be like live it, to be alive.
Absolutely.
And then just like you hear the cop sounds at the end, and yeah, it's just a really like ballsy way to end a movie like this, which apparently is just supposed to be like, oh, it's the third movie in a massacre series. This is going to be, like, probably as crazy as these get, but it's actually as, like, raw as they get.
Right, and you have the lingering idea of, like, the killer's cop uncle sexually abusing him, and mm-hmm. when you realize that motivation, you realize he slips into that personality of that really violent assault that occurred on him as a child repeatedly, presumably, you but at the same time he worships and reveres this man because yeah. he's a cop, because he's supposed to worship and revere him. He has yeah. this like it's I think the dilemma that a lot of men have in society when they are starting to like really like I don't know come into their own as men, in terms of I have to either double down on this behavior that I was inscribed in, like, or was inscribed to me by authority figures, or I have to push against it. And what mm-hmm. we see here with this killer is somebody who is slowly being just completely overtaken by it. And I think that that's really chilling, considering, like you mentioned, the police sirens at the end. It's like, ah, yes, these cops are going to come in and perpetuate the problem and not believe anything. Right. And it's just the whole thing's going to happen again to some other teens and some other town, and it's going to play out the same way. And it's not fun. Like, I wouldn't say any of these movies, except for maybe the second one and some bits of the first one, are fun. But it's the least fun out of all of them, because you realize that, like, there's not really a resolution. Everything's kind of screwed.
Right. And the fact that this one is completely separated from the other ones adds to the message where, like, this is just a constant theme that will continue to repeat itself until, like, the cycle is broken, which who knows if it ever can be or will be, you know? And I think absolutely. With having the uncle be a cop is such an intentional choice, where when you hear the cops, it's like, oh, great. And now the people that started this, you know, they're back. And it's just like such, I don't know, a very pessimistic movie, but not in the way like that. I don't know. I feel like that sounds like it could be negative if I say it's a pessimistic movie, but I think in like the best way, like the way that the message is relayed.
Yeah, I would say realist.
Mm-hmm. And I think that like much like something like say like a Necropolis or like a Breeders like would get written off because these are like direct to video. These are like this one didn't even come to theaters, right? Like this one was just straight to video. I think that it really shows that if you can skirt the line of making a marketable, like, seemingly tawdry movie, you can get away with, like, very challenging societal commentary on home video and direct-to-video movies, because not as many people are looking at that, and I think that, like, that's I think that that's the benefit of straight-to-video horror filmmaking of this era, is that it was it was very risky when it tried to be. When the right people were able to make money at little to no, or for little or no money. I just completely slipped up there. You had all of these complex ideas that weren't going through the corporate meat grinder. It wasn't like a only vague commentary that you saw in some of the later Friday the 13th movies. It was very on the nose because it could be. Because an executive wasn't saying, no, this is too pointed. This is going to hurt somebody's feelings. This poor cop is going to have a really bad night because of this. There's none of that.
And I think that's why the series is so good, is because it can get away with those things. It doesn't have to worry about the studios or, oh, how is this going to play in theaters? Are we going to have walkouts? It's such a low budget that they can risk those things.
Absolutely.
And I think that's why it's annoying to me when people dismiss these kind of movies because like, these are the movies where the art can shine as like the highest level because it has the least to lose. Where like something like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of like a modern example, like Greek Dune is coming out and like that's like has the highest stakes, or like even the new James Bond movie where like they're definitely going to lose money on that. Like the stakes are so high in movies like that it's really rare to see risks taken. And that's why I love movies like this, is because they can play with your expectations a lot more, and they can make you just like, I don't know. Remind me why I love film, because I love stories that are unpredictable and that are real and just give a really good vision of just a person's perspective.
Absolutely. And I think that there's something very telling about a society that prioritizes like you think back to the 80s, you think back to like what we consider to be 80s culture. It's like all Back to the Future and the Goonies, right? But like, when you have someone like my mom who grew up with these movies and like found solidarity in them and found solace in them and found like these movies that were made at cut rates for video distribution, like this is where she found solidarity. This is where a lot of women in the era saw their struggles accurately reflected. And I think it's very telling that these are the movies that we consider to be trash and not movies that are giant commercials from the 80s because we like the commercials that we're nostalgic for, right?
No, totally.
Yeah.
Gotta love capitalism.
Love it. My favorite economic model.
Oh, my word. So again, my ranking for this is 2-3-1. I don't dislike any of the movies, but that's just the order that just what I prefer, I guess, in movies, where the second one is like, I think, the most deeply layered, at least in terms of how you can watch it in a bunch of different ways. And then the last one, I think, is just very ballsy and risky and just something you wouldn't expect to see. And then the first one, though, is just a classic. Like, it is what you would expect going into a slasher while also having a lot of subtextual and just more interesting elements that maybe might not be present in other ones.
Absolutely. 100% agreed. Kayla, you've never seen any of these. What's your ranking? Where do you land on these?
Yeah.
I definitely think the second one was the most interesting in the way that it was structured and kind of written, and obviously had some more nuance to it. I did like the first one. I think the third one was good, but also just a lot for me in general.
Yeah.
Totally. Because, like I said at the beginning, slasher films just aren't necessarily my cup of tea. That's not to say I didn't enjoy, you know, any of these or think that they weren't, you know, I thought they were good movies. But I think the third one was just a little bit too abrasive for me. But I did really like the second one, and I really enjoyed the first one as well, and thought it was, you know, a little more campy, obviously, than the other two. I enjoyed them. I would recommend them to people who like this genre.
Definitely.
I also, one thing about the third one too that I appreciate is that it doesn't redo like the first one. It's not just a remake or a rehash. So it's like there is something different about all three. So I think there is something like each type of person can appreciate at least one of them because they're all very unique in the way that they present their message. So
I like to view this as like a anthology almost. Like I mentioned at the top of this, is like I think this is an anthology, a horror anthology about the varying types of misogyny that women face every single day of their lives, because all of them are geared and pitched towards very different audiences and critiquing similar but different facets of different things. So, like, there is a connection, obviously, between the first and second with Courtney, but it's still such a different movie, you're right. And so, like, I think that's how I view this series, is this anti-sexism anthology, which I really enjoy. Like, and for me, yeah, the second one is definitely my favorite. I just think it's a very honest depiction of how unrealistic and like just daunting trauma is. And I think the third one's my second favorite, just because of how it takes all of the themes of the series so far and is like, okay, but here's how it would play out in real life. And you're looking at this and you're just like, fuck. This is, yeah, you're right. It would play out like this. And I hate it. And the my least favorite, even though I still really love it, is that first one. Because, like, it's a classic, like you said. You pretty much said everything I have to say about the first one. So anything you said about that one is my take on that. Is like, I think it's a great film. I think it's a very deliberate film. And it's a horror classic at the same time. Like, I think the next two were more specific in their goals and more out there in terms of what they were trying to accomplish within the confines of a New World Pictures kind of joint, right? Or a Concord. I guess this was distributed by Concord and New World produced it.
Something, you know, there was a combination, maybe, who knows?
Yeah. So yeah, 2, 3, and 1 would be my ranking as well. Mm-hmm. Good movies.
Yeah, they are. All right, yeah, and that's our show for the week. And what is actually interesting is the way that I kind of planned to line this up, but also it just kind of happened, is this is coming out on Tuesday the 19th, and that means that 3 days ago, the remake of Slumber Party Massacre was released. So I don't know how it is, but, you know, if you want to, maybe that's a little bit of a connection there. You know, you watch that one, want to watch these, who knows? Yeah, it's just interesting, you know, like that always happens to us. Like we will plan an episode and then it's like, oh, it's Billy Crystal's birthday today. And we did a When Harry Met Sally episode. That didn't happen, but it was like something with like Goodfellas, where it was like the Goodfellas anniversary. It was like weird. So, you know, a little bit of a marketing tie-in, even though we are not connected to sci-fi. Bella, do you have anything you want to replug right here, just in case they forgot?
Oh, yeah, totally. I'm Bella Osma Blondo. You can find me on Twitter at VHS Vivitch. And you can follow my two shows, Ricchetto Punchy and I Hate Movies. And that's at Ricchetto Punchy on Twitter and at I Hate Movies Pod on Twitter as well. Come tell me how bad my opinions are. I definitely want to hear that.
We always love that. It's so great to hear people trash our opinions.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It feels good. It's like good for my self-esteem, I think.
Yeah. So you can we'll put all those in the show notes, and also in the show notes will be our email that you can email us at if you have thoughts on this episode, other episodes, maybe you have an episode idea. That's secondhandfilmcritics@gmail.com. And maybe if you have a fun comment, we'll read it in the upcoming episode. Who knows? Kayla, where else can they find us on the great wide world of the internet?
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search Secondhand Film Critics and we'll come right up.
You know where they can also find us is our website, which maybe at this point we'll have a blog post up. You're planning on writing one, maybe? I don't know. So yeah, this is our second episode of the spooky season, and we have one more episode coming up next Tuesday. This is a very exciting episode because it's like a little bit of a sequel to our last year's episode. Kayla, what are we talking about next Tuesday?
Oh my gosh, we are talking about Halloween Town 2, Calabar's Revenge. We have revisited our good friends, the Cromwells, in Halloween Town. And, of course, the real boys, Mitch and Zach, have returned. So make sure, now that you know it's coming, go ahead and listen to last year's Halloween Town episode on the first movie with them so that you can just join in right where we left off with the second movie next Tuesday.
Yeah.
I've never seen those, and now I'm going to go watch them and listen to y'all's episode.
Amazing.
Yeah,
introducing
people
to Halloween Town.
They're definitely different from Slumber Party, but...
Oh, yeah. They're such a 180, honestly, from these to Halloween Town, too. It just shows our range in our episodes.
true film appreciators.
Yeah, well, tune in then, and until next time, I am Noah.
And I am Kayla.
I'm Bella.
And
we're your second-hand
film
critics. Yeah.